I'm Lisa Anita Wagner.
And I am Lisa McEwen.
And together we are She's Got a Habit!
Exclamation mark.
Welcome, listeners. I like how this is Lisa Wagner, but I like how Lisa, other Lisa, always says, hello, listeners.
Yeah, thank you. I feel it is inclusive to interpolate our audience into our conversation.
Yeah.
And also to drop big, heavy academic words like that just for fun. And welcome to episode 6 of She's Gotta Have It! We will be talking about episode 5 of I Love Dick, A Short History of Weird Girls, directed by Jill Soloway.
Yes, my favorite episode.
Oh my gosh. But before we get into that, we got to do what we want. I realized looking at my notes that I have not thought about this at all. So what do you want?
Right now, I would like a little bit more physical ease. I felt like I had a pretty good handle on my body, and I did, and my upper back was kind of spasming. So I'm really focusing again a lot, like pretty much my whole time yesterday and today, on stretching. And you know, when you have like a bad physical day, you just realize how awesome it is to have better ones. So I'm like, I really want to put that consistent work, really do my best to make it habit. Yeah, even just legs up the wall and a few stretches, I think really makes a difference. So that's what I want. Better physical, not better, it's like increased physical alignment, body betterness.
Yes. Have we talked about our various mild, well, mine's more mild, our various illnesses and disabilities? You've talked about your EDS
a little bit, yeah.
On the intro episode. But I was just going to say that I relate to this as somebody with mild-ish sciatica, mild to medium. It used to be more severe, and I feel like I'm heading towards mild, which is nice. I don't have the pain, but I do have the creepy numbness, as you know, and so it does mean that, like, yeah, my mobility sometimes is a little impaired by that. And I've been walking around recently just being angry that I'm bad at walking. And I would like to be better at walking. But what I was going to say is that what I want is I want to get better at experimenting with a daily routine. Because I think as somebody who, I'm sure all the graduate students out there can relate to this, and also people like who are freelancers and stuff. I find it daunting actually just to have a whole day in front of me and to have no structure, because it means I have to constantly make choices, and so then I sometimes just default to routines that sort of work and sort of don't. And sometimes that's fine and sometimes it's frustrating, but I find that I would like to try and get out into the world earlier in the day, for example. So yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to experiment with that, and also update, I have started Marie Kondoing my apartment, and so I would just like to have that on the record as a thing that I have started doing.
Lovely. And I will say, as someone who sees you often, I remember when you used to be able to not sit at like social gatherings and you'd have to lie down and stuff. I've noticed that it definitely seems like you are on the betterness rise.
It helps
with
to
that.
Hear that, actually, because sometimes it's hard to gauge your own progress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, what we want. Surprisingly physical,
yeah.
But not sexual today.
And for a quite the episode. So, all right. So let's dive into A Short History of Weird Girls.
And we'll start with the Amazon description that Lisa is pulling up on her phone.
Yes. So the Amazon. Oh, that's not it. The Amazon description says,
it's brief.
It is very brief. The women of Marfa expose their history of desire. Do you want to talk a little bit about why this is your favorite episode?
Yes. I suppose for me, as someone who's made traditional narrative films and who has also now made a ton of like super weird art films, I'm very interested in marrying the two, because I do realize with the weirder films, there's an audience and there's things you can do with them. But I was always interested in bringing that in the appropriate doses and how that can marry with a traditional narrative structure. And I feel like this episode is really set up like a bunch of art films. I think that it works. I feel like it completely, I mean, I love it so much, it's maybe not the best for me to judge, but I feel like it really carries a viewer through the 20 minutes quickly, where sometimes if you try, I've seen where someone does artsy stuff, all of a sudden it's so, it just doesn't work. So I think this is a great example of an art style, sort of experimental style of storytelling that I think works really well. So I think that's the first thing that sticks out.
I agree that it carries you along, because these episodes, I mean, they are short episodes, but yeah. They're always still over before I think they're going to be. There's a nice sort of sequential structure with sort of miniature stories all kind of in parallel with each other.
Yeah, I feel like it's a really good example of storytelling. I also, I mean, again, I've watched it so many times, but even this time I'm like, oh, it's over already. Like, it does really move, because it kind of feels like, yeah, your interesting cool friend is telling you these interesting stories. That's sort of how it feels to me, and I guess that's an indication of, for me, it works. Like, I feel like it just pulls you in.
And
I guess in that, I didn't get much film training. I really learned on my feet, but I do remember people saying like, oh my god, don't do voiceover, never look right into the camera. So just really interesting, a lot of things that I'd heard of as quote unquote, like bad or poor or weak filmmaking are kind of turned on their head. Cause I love the setup where each section, different female characters from the show talk about, it is set up that it's all their desire for dick, but I know cause the overreaching thing is that the letters are letters to the patriarchy. So it's them showing their desire.
Have we mentioned this yet? I don't know.
I feel like we said it in the one I just cut.
We did, okay.
That Jill Soloway had mentioned that in an interview.
Because I just wanted to interject quickly to say, and this is just me feeling like I need to comment on a common misunderstanding of what the patriarchy is, which people often confuse the patriarchy with just all the men. That is not what the patriarchy is. Although it absolutely includes all of the men, it actually includes all of our culture, which is designed to promote the interests of certain kinds of people, and one kind of person whose interest gets promoted is men, where what kind of man you are will affect the different kind of barriers you have to various things. But our society is absolutely centered on prioritizing men as the more important people, even when we're all doing this unconsciously. And so a lot of the patriarchy gets perpetuated through systems that don't include people necessarily making conscious choices to prioritize men and to deprioritize or degrade women. It often just comes up in how people's judgments work. Studies have shown that if you have a woman and a man express the same sentiment, people will respond by saying that they perceive the man as just being naturally more confident and more capable. All these sorts of implicit bias is how patriarchy gets perpetuated, propagated in our society. However, I like the idea of personifying the patriarchy in dick, and just having dick be kind of like a little bit of a parody on what the patriarchy is, and just sort of embody that in a way that is hilarious and beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah. I also just, I need to tell a quick anecdote. This episode's going to be super long. Buckle up, listeners. But there's an anecdote where John Searle was giving a talk at a conference I was at about 7 years ago, made some offhanded comment that back in his day, people thought that men were conspiring in boardrooms against them. That's what feminists thought. And some female scholar, Ray Langton, in the audience almost screamed out, "Literally, no one has ever thought that." And he chuckled and said, "Well, back in my day." And she was like, "No, no one has ever thought that." And it was a beautiful moment to behold, because Ray Langton is in some ways a very kind of introverted, timid woman, except when she feels fueled by a fiery rage at John Searle. So there's my anecdote. Back to the episode. We're talking about the history of the desire of four different characters.
Each one of them addresses the camera. Also, another one of my favorite film things that I think Jill Soloway does great, gets to go back into the scene that they're talking about and kind of be a witness.
Yeah.
In the scene. Love that stuff.
Yeah. Can we just talk for a second about the importance of looking directly at the camera? So do you remember, because Jill Soloway has commented on this. I don't know if you remember this. It was in one of the interviews you sent me.
Was it? I don't remember.
I think it was in the one with Hannah Gadsby. She said that she didn't used to like photos of herself because she was always told to look askance.
Yeah, right? I remember this now.
And it sort of like gives off this sort of Sears portrait kind of vibe. That I also don't like about myself and never liked even as a child when people would be like, put your hands against your face and like tilt your head and look this way. I remember just thinking like, I look like an idiot. What she finds very powerful and that women are not encouraged to do, but men are, is to just look down the barrel of the camera. Because that is a very assertive thing to do.
Jill was talking about it in Hollywood in the paparazzi. And that makes perfect sense as well. And I just had heard about that in terms of filmmaking. And I had seen it in Harold and Maude, and it really kind of blew me away because all of a sudden it feels like the person talking is actually looking at you, which you see it more now. Like there's a lot more of it going on. In this episode, like it starts with Chris. She's literally glaring down the like lens of the camera as she's in her flashback. And I just love the use of it. So it is... I had heard, you know, like voiceover is just really weak filmmaking. Don't look down the barrel of the camera. And they just use these things so expertly. And it was so great. It felt so very Chris Kraus. Like she's taking you back in her memory. She's kind of ticked. She's right there staring. Mm-hmm. And then she's even in the flashback going through and looking through the books. So it just, I really love that melding of the worlds where you can, yeah, go back in time and witness it again.
And it, in a weird way, kind of like the opposite of what the dinner scene in the first episode does, which it positions Chris Kraus in the position of the audience when they're conspiring and commenting on her talent as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
When they lean in together and suddenly we're in the position of Chris Kraus. Suddenly the audience is in the position of Dick when, because they're talking to us, but they're really talking to Dick.
Oh, I never thought of that. Yeah.
And there is something... There is something kind of compelling and a little bit erotic about it.
Right. Yeah. That's right, because they all are saying, dear Dick.
Mm-hmm.
It seems so obvious, I just never really put that together, that that's who the gaze is directed at.
Yeah. But, I mean, also with the audience, right? There's levels.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, yeah, just in terms of that level of narrative... that Chris Kraus is glaring down the barrel at Dick.
And
it's extra funny.
It's kind of for the benefit of the audience because these are all hypotheticals, I think, because she said, what if we all wrote you letters? Like, it's not like...
That's right.
In the world of the story, this has actually happened.
And I was curious about that because I'm finishing the book right now. This is a created part that wasn't in the book. So I was a whole other ball of yarn, but so interesting.
Yeah.
It's real. I think it just really works in this way. And then bringing in the art as well. So there's that film where it sort of seems like 70s softcore porn and the women are covered in white.
Yeah. What is the white about, do you think?
I've thought about this a lot. What it seems to me is that because the woman's kind of in the actual piece of art that looks like the 70s porn, she's really invisible. Like, it doesn't really matter if she's there or not.
Yeah.
That's what it sort of meant to me. And then the different women, as they were telling their stories, as it whited out, was usually when they kind of also became invisible in that same kind of way and were seeing themselves through the invisibility. But what confused me, if you use that, is why when Toby first watched porn... which she seemed to really be fascinated by, she went white. So that's the one that confused me in terms of, like, that.
Yeah, and also Devin, when she gets up and puts her arm around that woman that...
I think that's her mom.
Oh, is it?
Because her mom, I just from watching it a bunch, her mom's mom looks like she's having an affair with Dick.
Yeah.
So it's like the family was standing around, and the mom's there, who seems like the head of the family, and then Dick kind of comes in and does... this.
Oh.
And then okay. When Devin went and put her hand on Dick, she did move the space, but she still remained invisible. Like, it wasn't like she got his status when she stood there. That's what I think I understand from it.
Because, yeah, I think... Okay, so here's a half-formed thought that's going to come out right now.
Oh, awesome.
Is that it's both indicating female desire, but also the kind of weird invisibility of that.
Of it, yeah.
Maybe something about this. So,
because it seems really like the one that seems the most clear is when it is Chris, because yeah. Silver is kind of creepy and he's like, take your clothes off, leave your boots on, smile. No, don't smile, don't smile, don't smile.
Oh
it
God,
was like, it's so funny. Like, yeah, I think that Griffin Dunne is so good at Silver. Like, he's just so perfectly European, academic, creepy. But that seems more clear. Like, again, Chris is really into it. She likes. Ask like things about him, you know, you can't freak him out, she said. But it seems pretty obvious that he's like objectifying her, but there is a loop where she's still getting something. But yeah, he's like kind of saying all that. So that made sense to me why she was white there, because just going back to her past, remember she kind of even gets next to her old self and kind of looks like, I feel like she really is. I feel like thinking about it maybe differently from revisiting it.
Because it also, I mean, and this is hard to tell, and so a lot of this is a speculation, but what it also looks like is, it's like white light, but it also looks like there's maybe like a compilation of things running through a reel. Like, it almost looks like there's different forms, and you can't quite see what they are.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of wondering if part of it is that as these women experience like their initial moments of desire, they're somehow being kind of caught up in a whole history of women's desire that is somehow in some ways mysterious and invisible, and so difficult to... I feel like this is a lot of speculation. I'd have to like write an essay on this and think more about this. There's something about how it's almost impossible to depict because we haven't really come up with ways to do that. And so in this, like, way of suggesting it, it also erases their individuality. I don't know if that... And it might not be for them. It might just be for whoever's looking at them. I don't know. There's something...
I was intrigued and thought about it quite a lot. And that, I think, is really the only time where they really do take... Because that is an art... sort of technique devised by someone back in the day, and then they actually brought it into the filmmaking of this piece. So it does seem very deliberate.
So in Chris Krause's History of Desire, which is the first one we witness, she says something about women being compilations. And this gets picked up again when Toby discusses her education in art history and like the kind of the geometry of the perfect breast,
yeah,
and the way in which like somehow there is going to be an ideal that is kind of like everyone and no one. And it really reminds me some stuff that John Berger talked about in Ways of Seeing, about how in the history of painting nudes, the painter Dürer, which I'm probably not saying as Germanically as maybe it should be, Dürer. you are the German person. He said that the ideal nude wasn't any one woman in particular. It was just a literal compilation of, like, arms and breasts and ratios and hips and thighs, which really squicks John Berger out, and he seems very annoyed at that suggestion that that would somehow be an ideal of beauty. But I feel like that theme kind of comes up throughout as well.
Yes. I actually didn't catch her say the word compilation, but it makes sense.
It was in relation to her... She wanted to fuck a rock star, and she went with her friend, and they wanted to fuck him, like, together, but, like, as one person. It's sort of... It was a bit hard to follow exactly what the idea was there, but the idea was, I think, if he liked them together enough, then it didn't matter who they were as individuals.
There's a term that they use in there, and I think it's... I was going to actually look it up, but I never did. Cyborgian split or Cyorgian split.
Yeah, I didn't know what that meant either.
And I was wondering if it's going to do with cyborg, but she said every woman experiences this Cyborgian split that, like, I think it said culture sort of presses on us. We are now Googling.
There's an article called From I Love Dick to Louie. Meanwhile, I Love Dick is a running homage and syllabus of female artists. One episode opens with a woman swallowing and spitting a white liquid streaming from a hole in a bright green jug, an actual video work by Cheryl Donegan called Head. In another, Chris tells us she once based a threesome, which is this fucking the rock star with her friend, on Louise Bourgeois' sculpture The Couple from 2003, Two twisted and interlocking chrome figures she analyzes as representing the cyborgian split projected onto every woman in this culture. So the concept of a cyborg, right, is the idea of like human plus technology. You are a cyborg if you have like a computer chip in your head, or there's like a lot of different scientific or sci-fi examples of this. But in fact, if you have an IUD, you are a cyborg.
I was a cyborg for years.
I am a cyborg right now. So if you, you know, if you have like a, or a metal plate in a limb or something like that. And so what I think she's doing is extending that idea to technology and media. And what she's saying is that women experience themselves as themselves, like so from a first person perspective, but also they experience themselves within this whole history of the way that women have been depicted and kind of the ways in which their sense of themselves, I think, melds, but is still distinct from these different other women that you see depicted in the media, because you're always in some sense thinking of yourself in relation to them because of the way our society depicts women. And John Berger talks about this in Ways of Seeing, that women can't just experience themselves in a pure way. They always also, I mean, it's, I'm sure there's some examples out there of women who don't experience this. And I'm sure it's on some level of a spectrum. You know, some people may or may not relate to this strongly. You are living your life and you're also watching yourself live your life to various degrees. And I certainly know that I have this and I find it incredibly aggravating. I really wish I didn't. But especially in certain situations, I find myself thinking about how somebody would be watching me do what I'm doing as I'm doing it, even when it doesn't matter, like even when I'm alone. Simone de Beauvoir also talks about this as the kind of basic phenomenological state of being a woman. And so I think there is always a kind of fractured sense of yourself as a woman that men aren't socialized into. And that is, for Simone de Beauvoir anyway, one of the fundamental conditions of being a woman. Because for her, women are socialized, we're not born. So there isn't anything fundamental biologically about women. What it means to be a woman is to be raised in a society that one of the many facets of being a woman is to think of yourself in this fragmented kind of way.
Cyborgian split.
That is the best job that I can do of explaining that. And the article I quoted about the scene from I Love Dick is called From I Love Dick to Louie, Can TV Shows Help People Understand Art? And is in The Guardian by Travis Deal, Wednesday, the 17th of May, 2017. So if our listeners want to go look that up and have a read.
What the cyborgian split is.
Yeah. I would like applause. An applause sound effect. So do you want to just dive into what we think about each of their stories?
Sure. With Chris's, I guess it was just so, the first one, mm-hmm. It was so interesting also to see, like, Sylvaire looks about the same age. Like, she looks, like, in her 20s. So just, that was just interesting.
Yeah.
I have never heard someone say I've been horny since I was it 8 or 6?
6.
Since I was 6.
Yeah. I kind of, like, it's also, so first of all, like, we're not used to talking about childhood sexuality in this culture, so it feels, like, very shocking, I think, even, that they're so forthright about it. But, yeah, that they all start about in their childhoods.
Yeah. And she's super clear what that means for her. It means, like, humping a
rhino.
A rhino in her family's living room. With her babysitter, Karen Harris. I just find it so clear. It seems so real. Like, it seems like one of those things. And I feel like the setup to it really seems like a memory. Like, when you think of something, you talk about your past, and it's like you have these flashes. Like, Karen Harris was standing there awkwardly, looking like she's ready to get paid or wanting to go home.
Yeah.
And then you saw a couple of images of, like, the picture on her wall. I think the carpet, but it just seems very much based in emotion and memories, the way the flashbacks are. And that was so funny. Then Chris Krauss was like, and then, you know, Karen went to university and I just didn't want to do it anymore. So it also has this really interesting kind of flippant.
Because maybe also there was something in someone watching her do it.
Yeah, that's what it sort of seems like.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the show of her early kink
before
she knew what it was at all.
One of the things that delighted me about her story was how she fell in love with Jesus Christ.
Oh, yes.
Even though she's Jewish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to say that I love this because I also had a huge crush on Jesus Christ, and I really hope that none of my family is listening to this. Because it sort of seems like very sacrilegious to say this, but honestly, he's our
he's
type.
He's got a good body type.
He's tall and skinny with
and like some long hair.
Oh my God.
Well, I briefly went to the Catholic credit union, and it was creepy, but there was a life-size Jesus over the tellers, and it looked like his, I was like, that's a great body. Like, I always thought that when I would see it, especially life-size. So yeah, I really connected with that. I think, and I did have a childhood friend who thought Jesus was hot, both a guy and a woman who both were like into Jesus. So, and I will say, this will give us another explicit rating on this episode.
Excellent.
But one of my favorite t-shirts I ever saw in Blair West Village, I saw a guy with a shirt with a rainbow that said sucking cock for Jesus. And it just has to be brought up that whenever I see that, it's just so funny. Sorry to offend any Jesus lovers with the shirt. But anyway, so her having, anyway, that's the whole Jesus context, but yeah, her having a crush on Jesus, and then saying his man bun and his kind of hippie good looks, it was just perfect.
Exactly. I mean, she describes him as like a hot 70s yogi, and it's like, yeah, that is exactly what he looks like, and that is exactly my type. So, yeah, beard and the long hair.
And I loved her version of that, too, her memory, where she's just hanging out, like, yeah, doing sketches of him, and he just kind of wanders in his loincloth with his blood, being like, hey. Yeah. Oh, so it really seemed like the perfect, version of whatever her age was, but how she would imagine that going, and then maybe he'd kiss her, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, however it kind of goes down. So it seemed very real to me. And what was the end part of Chris's?
It was the Silver episode, and then she was talking about how their sex life started out very hot and kinky and then kind of took a nosedive after they got married.
Another moment of interest, because she was talking about how she knew he had other lovers and she didn't care, but when she says, oh, and I thought when I was sick that was the end of our relationship, but then she's like, but then he said, let's get married, now go on your insurance, and she kind of beamed. Like, it was just an interesting moment where she seemed like she really actually liked that someone really wanted her.
Yeah.
So it was just an unexpected response, but very genuine and interesting. And then I guess, yeah, she talks about how it started so hot, and then it's kind of...
They went from kinky sex to vanilla sex to
no sex.
She talks about what dick has fired back up in her, and she says, I forgot what lust feels like. I don't care how you see me. I don't care if you want me. It's better if you don't.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. In part because I think that it means that for her, desire is for her.
Yeah.
In a way that it's not about achieving something specifically, but about her finding a part of herself that she feels like she's lost.
And then right at the end is when she says, what if we all wrote you letters, right? So then she calls the rest of the episode into being.
Yes.
And gets some other interesting characters. Oh, that's right. It starts with her saying she wonders what the desire of other women look like.
Yeah.
Right. That's how it starts right at the beginning. And then, and then she calls into being some other characters to sort of do the same thing in the letter style, which I really like. I like the form of letters. I like that a lot. So I think it's just a really good way to also give more insight into these characters.
I love direct address. Like, I like reading advice columns kind of for this reason, because there is like a kind of, I mean, this is a very different situation, but I like the way that it allows you to just speak like personal truths to each other that aren't necessarily like you wouldn't find that in a kind of in an essay, not in the same way. There's something powerful about it.
And in a way, that's what Chris is doing with this whole thing. Whatever she wants to say is like the direct message. I guess in a way, it's sort of like I'm not up on my theater stuff. Like, a soliloquy is essentially addressing the audience, not in that concrete way. But yeah, but it is rare. And I feel like, but yeah, you really sort of see these, especially of the smaller characters that you don't know that well, you really learn a lot from them addressing and them choosing what elements of their story to tell.
You're right, though, that's a very Shakespearean kind of trope, the soliloquy, that you don't really find in modern drama. But yeah, you're right. They are very much like soliloquies.
Because it kind of lets you in on stuff. You're just with the person. Yeah, so it's interesting. I was thinking it was like all this like art film style, the breaking rules, but it is kind of a different art form
and
that
calling
exists.
Calling back a really old one
at the same time. Devin's letter.
Where she starts off watching him as a child in her mother's kitchen.
I love the little Devin. Oh my God.
I wanted to grow up to be like you.
Yeah. And I just think it's interesting too. Like she brings it up starting right off the bat. Like my grandparents, we pretend we didn't work for you. So it's like, we're kind of friends, but not really. So she just sort of starts by telling the truth and then saying straight up that she wanted to be exactly like you. Like Dick, in the letters to Dick, and the little detail of like, yeah, I really wanted cowboy boots to be like you, or ask my parents, and it didn't seem they had a lot of money, but they're like, they got them because even my parents thought it was cool to be like Dick. So you could really see the culture of Dick loving.
Yeah.
That sentence sounds very funny.
And the way that we see Devin like emulating that is partly through this like cold, distant exterior that somehow manages to facilitate female desire, right?
Yeah.
Because she grows up and all these little girls fall in love with her and she's like, sorry, I'm not interested anymore. And they're, you know, yelling at her until she gets to college.
And she said she did delight in that too. She was like, yeah, I broke their, I wrote poems that broke their heart. And she really did seem to see that as a, she just seemed to delight in it, I guess.
Yeah. The power and
the power in it.
With it. Yeah.
And then it is interesting because in the dynamic with her and Toby, she's trying so hard to be that cool one, but she is the one that's like, oh,
you're so right.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit like how her college situation goes too. And actually now, okay, so let's just mention this. So in college, she falls in love with a woman whose name is Sharon, who's a cellist, who then she runs into on a date with a man at some point because Sharon is too ashamed to tell the world that she's either a lesbian or that she's bi. Devin is heartbroken and returns to Texas.
Yeah.
And yeah, now that in retrospect, Toby's shirking of her at the bar in favor of this random dude who doesn't seem that interesting now has a kind of more poignant ring to it.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that Toby was, I mean, interested. Like, she's interested in the man camp and, like, in some parts of it. But, yeah.
But I think part of what Devin's journey is that she realizes that she can be like Dick all she wants, but she's, A, not like Dick.
Dick, yeah.
And also, she doesn't have the power and the status that comes with being a cis hetero man. Because people are gonna, like, either be ashamed of her or somehow, like, be more interested in man instead.
Yeah, and be secretive about it. Like Sharon, her girlfriend, she even said, I think, didn't tell anyone or didn't tell her family at all.
Yeah.
Because it looked like they were living together. It was hard to tell, but they were definitely like, seemed like they were in bed together a lot and stuff.
Yeah.
And in that one bedroom. Their sex scene was an interesting example, too, of just another one that was still very intimate, definitely sensual, but not like ooey, like you were in the middle of the wrong place, like how you feel with Silver. But seemed... like, sorry, Silver. Didn't mean to be in here.
God, yeah.
But it just seemed like, it actually seemed really like a good version of a very like loving sex scene, which is what I was trying to do to show that it seemed like, while it might have been short, I had the sense like, they might have only lived together for a few months. It seemed very almost like fairy tale, like come to bed, okay, if I've got to. And then they, have just really intimate moments that weren't super sexual. But just seemed really, like, lovely and loving.
Yeah.
And then she
flunked out of school and came back to Texas to figure out who she should become.
Who she should become. I like that a lot.
Which seems to be her journey, at least, right? Partly through this season. Well, then we move on to...
Paula. So, yeah. So she's the curator that is running the gallery space that Dick seems to own. Like, I don't really understand if it's his gallery or if he's, like, the head, the overseeing curator.
I get the sense it's his gallery.
Because he does walk away from it at one point, I think, in a later episode. So it's hard. Yeah, it sort of seems like that.
Okay. So we get her story, and like we don't know very much about her at all. So that was very exciting. And I would just like to start off by saying that Michael J. Fox was her first love. Also, after Jesus, Michael J. Fox was also my
first crush.
He was one of my very first celebrity crushes, and it was very intense, and I was 14 or something.
Aww.
Yeah. Just watching, like, the Back to the Future movies and also some, like, Doc Hollywood, which is, like, a long-forgotten movie of the 80s where he plays this, like, fancy city doctor and goes to a southern town and falls in love with one of the residents there. But they all hate him because he's a city man. Oh, I remember that forming some of my initial feelings about romance.
adorable. I love her character, Paula, we just said, right?
Yep.
And also, yeah, unexpected character that you don't really know too much about. And then I just loved the details, yeah, of her crush on Michael J. Fox.
And that it's actually his conservative
like Alex character. P. Keaton, yeah, yeah, the character. Did you like Michael J. Fox as just an individual person, or did you like Alex P. Keaton?
I did not really watch, what was the show?
Family Ties.
I have definitely seen a number of episodes, but that was not what made me fall in love with him. It was absolutely Back to the Future. So it was like Marty McFly,
got it.
But then also just him in different movies. And I think I didn't quite feel like he was sort of one of those actors who was hired to play versions of himself a little bit.
Yeah.
Or versions of the same character who was like kind of like well-intentioned, sometimes a bit brash, but, like, you know, made mistakes, but was very endearing. And so, yeah, I liked him.
So she's into Alex P. Keaton. And I just remember he was, like, yeah, just, like, this real, like, kind of conservative, preppy guy. And I found his character, like, actually, like, kind of the opposite, like, repulsive. But that's why it was so, like, just delightful to see the Shape of Desire is so different, you know?
And it seemed like that was so super transgressive for her.
Yeah.
Given her mother's extremely left liberal politics.
Exactly. So it was that thing of what was just different.
It's like, you know, Chris Kraus, who's a Jew, falls in love with Jesus. Or just, yeah, yeah. Those just examples of transgression that are interesting. And I just loved her talking about how she used to love her mother, who was this political feminist who was trying to get first woman vice president elected.
And I did like the story point too of that she was really into her mom, and then one day she saw her mom's tampon string and something just turned in her. And that's
broke my heart.
It's really sad. Yeah. But it's just such an interesting, like, honest emotional journey that most people wouldn't necessarily say or tell or know about.
Yeah.
But to be so upfront about it, I never had something like that, but it was so well shown. You could sort of feel it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In terms of this thing of like suddenly being kind of turned off by something. So I guess too, in a traditional storyline, that's not a detail that I've ever heard before or had somebody, yeah, kind of talk about. So I guess, again, remember we talked earlier about how this like sort of an emotional storyline, like Chris Kraus, like zigzagging around. So I feel like this was also a very emotional story point based on, because I think a different storyteller would be like, but why? And keep looking for the why, even though she's like, yeah, I just saw that and it changed me.
Well, and I think, you know, she starts out by talking about how she thought, she's again putting, like making her mother into pieces, because she says, I love my mother's hands,
oh, yeah.
I love my mother's neck, right? This is, again, the same way that like women are often depicted, right? Like in terms of like parts of their bodies. And I think what the tampon did was it just destroyed the magic, because it's like, this is a reality of having a body and there are bodily fluids. And like the tampon isn't gross at all. Like, I like how they just depicted it as like just
a white string
out
in his
there.
Face.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. I remember her saying she wanted to chop one of her mom's hands off and just have it with her.
Which
yeah.
is adorable, but also totally disturbing.
And she also said her mom's hands were smushy and squishy, I think. So I was like, I wonder, because I have a smushy hand. So I was just curious.
Very smushy.
But
can't keep you in handcuffs.
You actually can't. So, haha, authorities. No, no one's ever tried to put me in them for legal reasons. But Paula's storyline is really one of my favorites, and it's just that unexpected Michael J. Fox and her watching the news in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And putting a little picture of him heart in her necklace. It's kind of charming and interesting and refreshing, and then
Yeah,
and then you know about her. And I did also just the way she explains the feeling of presenting stuff to Dick. Dick just walks away because if he doesn't like it. So it was interesting to see her experience with Dick too and her frustrations with that.
Just Kevin Bacon's face is amazing. Like just like the dispassionate sort of look of lack of impressiveness.
Yeah, he looks super bored. And then also like he's just like shooting out of, like he just can't wait to get out of the scene too.
She talked about his work evoking boundlessness and that she really liked that he refuses to name anything.
Right. I
what
forgot
do you
the
make
connection.
Of that?
I remember even this time I was like, how does she get from her Michael J. Fox story into the Dick letter? Like I was trying to remember that. And it was, yeah, about the boundlessness. And what was even the, what was the linking thing she said about how she loved Michael J. Fox because so opposite from her mom. Mm-hmm. And then that she liked to read and masturbate. And then that reminded her of Dick's work. I just was trying to like think of, because they'll have pretty clear through lines.
I think what happens is then she just shifts and she just said, the first time that I saw your work, it just evoked a kind of, almost the way that people will talk about sublime experiences, like a kind of boundlessness where you feel almost insignificant in contrast to, often it's a scene of nature, but there are arguably artworks that might evoke that sense of boundlessness as well. And there being maybe like some sort of lack of boundaries. I don't know, there's being a kind of fluidity between you as a subject and your experience of the artwork as a whole. But just his refusal to name anything, interesting to me. I don't really know what to make of that other than it's very depersonalized. Like, it's like he refuses to kind of, because like, naming things is a really intimate thing to do.
I think it's a loving act. Like, when I name my projects, I feel like it's like, yeah, almost like maternal.
It is, and I think one of the many reasons that I felt safe searching for my bio family is that I found out that my bio mother had named me. And when I heard that, that was one of the tipping points for me where I thought, yeah, okay, I think it might be okay to find this person, which I didn't know until 2 years ago.
I remember hearing that detail too, and it also stayed with me because that shows, yeah, it just has a value.
Michaela Marie was my very first name.
Oh, I don't think I think I thought it was Maria originally, and then, yeah.
My mother misremembered it as Maria. That's when I first found Michaela. Yeah, but Michaela Marie.
Michaela Marie.
Yeah, which is, it's funny because I didn't really know any Michaelas until a couple of years ago. And I have a weird relationship with that name because I went to high school with a woman who was from the Bahamas who pronounced her name Michaela. And so whenever I go to say Michaela, I sort of overcorrect and then accidentally say Michaela. It's a whole thing. I get very stressed out saying that name. It was very heartwarming and touching to find out that I had been named.
And I think Dick's refusal to name stuff is a bit with that, how he keeps everybody at arm's length too, because it doesn't reveal anything about him.
Yeah.
It doesn't say how he feels about it or what he thinks about anything.
Because maybe in contrast to the way that like women have this this sort of fluid sense of self, Dick is kind of a solid, unique individual that cannot be penetrated, and he wants to keep it that way. So he likes keeping things at a distance to keep himself kind of apart.
Yeah,
and singular.
Safe and singular, like a brick.
And it is safe, because it is something where you're totally eschewing any kind of vulnerability.
Yes. And how did Paula's end?
With her exhibit ideas all being rejected by Dick. And then she looks into the camera and says something, I'm still waiting to see what you'll say yes to, or something like that.
The fourth one, unless we have
other
thoughts, is Toby. Yeah, and it opens with a...
Dear great man, genius, loner cowboy. Which I thought was such a beautiful... It's unclear, but I'm pretty sure she's saying that a little bit sarcastically. It feels like she's saying it...
I wasn't sure. I think she might be genuine, but I don't... Like, I'm not... It's not clear.
You can also read it on two levels. One, she's serious, and then... But it is also, like, a ridiculous thing to say to somebody. But he is all those things. Well, I don't know if he's a genius, but loner cowboy. Certainly.
But I think what made me think maybe it was more earnest is when they show the picture of her opening the book, it's her small child hand, and the small child hand was like almost like just like caressing the Dick picture in this way that made it seem like since childhood she'd been admiring him.
Yeah.
So that's why I thought it could be actually just genuine.
Yeah, no, that seems right. And I mean, a lot of, we've talked about this before, but a lot of her work emulates the kind of formalism that he also explores in his work, right? So,
and her way of, he refuses to name stuff. She refuses to talk about the politics of her work. Like, it's this very similar, keeping lovers at a distance, not wanting to commit to stuff. And it opens on this. I remember looking up that video because I was a bit confused about that one, but it looks kind of like almost like softcore porn with a unicorn in the back and a girl flipping up her skirt.
Oh, yeah.
So it's that same note of very deliberate sexuality that sort of Toby rocks, where, you know, really short skirt, like little, it almost looks like she's dressing like a little girl for someone's gaze, but she's clearly not doing that. Like, it's like her own thing and she's being herself, but it's that same kind of mix, I suppose.
Which also just reminds me of like her, I mean, it is her, but she's sort of, while she wears that stuff, It's like she refuses to acknowledge the sexual nature of her clothes, like the ways in which her clothes kind of sexualize her in a way that, I mean, I actually find it refreshing to see her just like kind of, she walks around very unselfconsciously, right? You see her kind of walking up the stairs in the lecture hall and you can see like right up her skirt. She just like, she probably knows that. She doesn't care.
Yeah.
So yeah, in the same way that she sort of like refuses to acknowledge the politics and the more emotionally vulnerable topics of pornography.
And then when they first show her dad with the book, so her dad, she said, was an expert in gifted children.
Yeah.
And
or maybe thought he was.
Yeah, I forgot what the wording was, but he had a book that she showed. So that looked like that's probably what afforded their lifestyle.
Or maybe he wrote it.
That's
maybe
what it seemed like, because I think it was her last name on the book. So it seemed like he wrote the book about the gifted child, and I think the line was she thought he had the right to touch me.
Ooh.
So yeah, so it sort of it just gives more insight into her whole situation.
Yeah, which I have mixed feelings about, because it seems like that is such a cliche that some woman who has a weird relationship to sexuality must have been abused by somebody at some point. Sometimes cliches are cliches for a reason. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a way in which that makes sense. And the way, the dispassionate way she just describes that. Like,
And I did get the sense, too, I'm not like that, it was unclear the name. Definitely it was some weirdness happened. But just the way she said, he touched me, and then they showed, like, her skin going up. It was vague.
Mm.
But, yeah, still showing that there was something
inappropriate
in that domain for sure.
Yeah.
And then also the good use of intimacy when they showed the dad and the mom, and they only showed her mom literally for half a second. You saw her face, and then she walked away from the dad, and then the dad took a girl that looked sort of like Toby and similar to Toby's age, took her by the hand and said, "This is the woman that my dad left my mom for." And it had the same intimate shots of like just sort of in the neck, the hands, and you felt again like you were Toby as a kid, sort of right there with your dad and his new girlfriend. It felt like you were almost too intimate in with them.
And then she goes on to be an art history major and gets bombarded with, she said there was 500 female nudes in, or 500 times the number of female nudes as female artists. Which, I mean, I sort of liked that. Like, there was the initial shot of her in art history class. She looked so bored and frustrated.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that, because you don't often see her exasperated in that way. But also just reminded me again, the John Berger thing, of just, like, the way in which female nudes are constructed and the way that they're a whole trope within art history. And her then jump to pornography as being kind of similar is a little bit what John Berger is saying about what art history is. And I actually find that an incredibly poignant point, because these male professors who can stand there, and there's like geometric kind of like diagrams around the shape of these women's breasts from art history, and yet she's got pornography up on the screen, and everyone looks super uncomfortable. Because suddenly it feels extremely inappropriate to them. And I think that there's a lot of parallels between pornography and art history.
Totally. But it is interesting, because she takes it like, so first of all, just the morphology of the breast, you're like, yes. Then it was what a woman's face looks like when she sucks two cocks. Fair enough. And then she took it to gaping, which is just like,
sure,
just that extra little bit. So it's of interest. She's like, she's pushed. So she's like, I refuse to talk about this stuff. We're only doing this stuff, and I'm going to push it so hard. Because she must know that that's hard to watch, but she's acting like it's not.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And then the conversation with her professor after that, where he's like, maybe you should be in gender studies. And she just looks at him and she's like, why would you say that to me? And like, there's a couple of ways in which you can react to that. Because on the one hand, I mean, you talk about feminism in any discipline, and somebody will tell you that maybe you should be in gender studies. Like, people have, and in very good and helpful ways, said to me that, like, I might apply for jobs in women's studies departments as well as philosophy departments, because my niche of philosophy is also just a bit weird and esoteric. But I think this just is a default thing that happens to any woman who's interested in feminism in relation to the discipline she's in. Just gets kind of shuffled off to the gender studies department, because we don't want to talk about that here. We want to talk about that over there.
Yes. I do feel like that came up in the story, though, when she was doing the thing with gaping, when they didn't know what to do with her anymore. So I thought it was interesting. Yeah. It was interesting, you know?
No, for sure.
Because I could see, it was almost like she was sort of pushing them in this weird corner and then just sitting there and staring at them while they didn't know what to do with her.
And daring them, to call her out on it being
dare them,
too explicit.
Yeah, and then her letter ends with a threat to Dick. She's like, I'm not far behind you.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. She still loves him, but she's not, hers is not pretty and hers is not a love letter.
Yeah.
Hers is something else.
Yeah.
But I still do think it's not ironic, but it's just something else.
And it's sort of interestingly parallels Devin's narrative, right? Because they both want to be like Dick, but in different ways.
Yeah.
And they both have modeled themselves on him in different ways. By the way, though, I just have to go back to the scene of her dissertation defense, where there's this scene of, like, all those male professors looking awkward and horrified and, like, leaving one at a time. And in the front row center, there's a woman professor who looks completely fascinated by what she's saying and a little bit shocked because she's actually, like, learning
about gaping.
And probably also just about pornography in general in that kind of vain, because she doesn't look like the kind of person who's seen a lot of pornography just recreationally.
Although you never know.
She did have these looks on her face like, what?
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's amazing. But yeah, the final, it wasn't quite a taunt and it wasn't quite a threat, but it was just like a warning. Like, I'm going to catch up to you.
Because I'm trying to think of what it actually was. It was like something like, you may have 30 years on me, but I'm not far behind.
Yeah.
So yeah, actually, almost like it's like those Dick statements. Like, it's just the statement sentence. Not quite a threat, but you feel a little threatened. And like, Toby, what an interesting character. Yeah, and I guess just for me, again, this is such a favorite episode because it pleases me. They're all funny also, but it's like funny. I feel like I think it's 21 minutes long. It feels like it's 10 minutes to me, and it always just makes me sort of feel good. So I think that's why I endlessly revisit it, and we'll just watch it as a sort of standalone.
And it functions as a kind of standalone.
Well, actually, one of my friends who wants to listen to the podcast but hasn't seen any of them, he said, what episode? And I was like, 5. Because I do think, even though Dick, in a way, has so little, you see him only say a few lines and sitting there with his nudity in his blanket. Such a sense. Like, I think it's really tight filmmaking. Because in that 20 minutes, you really, even if you know nothing else about Dick, you get a sense of who he is from how all those women respond to him.
Yeah.
And him just sitting there with his face. I know a lot of my artist friends talk about this, like, the white male artist, which I think is exactly what he is. Mm. And he's parodying.
Mm-hmm.
Parodying?
Parodying.
That's a tricky one for my mouth. But yeah, where they often will have more accolades, get quite famous and quite rich, where that's not something that happens a lot to women artists.
Yeah.
So I had sort of heard about this mythical kind of thing.
Which is why it's sort of too bad there's only one season, because I would have liked to have seen where Toby would go. Because I feel like, for her, she's still up against a similar thing to Devin, which is like, they're still not men, and so they're still not treated the way they want to be treated.
Yeah.
And that, I think, comes up in an earlier episode where Silver says, like, why are you interested in porn? What does he say? You're so beautiful?
So I think he said, why are you obsessed with porn? So when it's her, when it's his work, I'm sure he wouldn't think he was obsessed with the Holocaust.
Right.
So it's, why are you so obsessed with porn? So condescending. And then what was the thing you were just going to say?
She says, like, he says something like, you're so achingly beautiful. And then she says, you're awful. Because, like, it is a really dismissive and condescending thing to say.
Yeah. And I think I already mentioned this, but also he says, like, one of the art prizes, but he's like, she got a Fulbright for that? Like, just like, he can't even
Guggenheim.
Believe. She got a Guggenheim for that? I think she said it to him. You got a Guggenheim for that? Like, I think he even said it right to her. Like, that's like the most insulting thing.
Oh, fucking Silver.
Silver.
Smile. Don't smile. Smile. Oh, no. That was a mistake. Oh, man. This guy.
Silver. Yeah. So, yeah. A short history of weird girls.
I think that's all I have to say.
That's, I feel like it's, 67 minutes. We are quite a bit over our traditional 46.
Oh my goodness. Well, we're just prepping our listeners for the...
We are.
For the greatness to come. Because I think once we invite other people on here, the conversations of three people will just naturally...
exponentially grow with interest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was really excited to talk about this episode. I think about it a lot and why I think it works. And, I really think it's this sort of lovely art film inspired episode in a pretty cool series.
Thanks for listening to episode 6 of She's Gotta Have It. Now that we've said it,
we've gotta get it. Woo! That was a very weak. That was
high
better.
Five. High five.